the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, I'd like to welcome everybody today to the Huffines Sports Medicine Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading us and taking the time to listen. We are absolutely very excited today to have Dr. Wendy Court here with us via telephone for our podcast. Dr. Court is a professor of medicine in the geriatric medicine division at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. I think I said that right. I hope I did. She originally got her PhD from Arizona State University, and if I did a full introduction on her, it would take us probably at least half an hour to go through all of her honors and titles. Wendy, we're just so pleased to have you here on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's an honor for me to be able to talk with you today, Tim.
Well, thank you. And I'd also like to tell everybody, and I'll remind everybody again, that Dr. Court is going to be here on campus at Texas A&M and going to be doing a public talk on the evening of November the 30th. In the Interdisciplinary Life Sciences Building Auditorium on the first floor. And that's scheduled for 6:45 in the evening right now. So we would welcome everybody to come out and see Dr. Court in person as well. But let's just get started here. And let me start with Dr. Court. What attracted you to your field of study?
Boy, that's an interesting question, Tim, because I started out actually as a math major as an undergrad, but I was also an athlete, so I was always interested in exercise and sports. And when I started out in graduate school at Arizona State University, I wanted to combine my interests in numbers and exercise, and I thought I was going to go into biomechanics. But while I was in graduate school, I took a couple of physiology courses that just completely enthralled me, and I got hooked in understanding the physiology of the body, and I've never looked back.
Yeah. Oh, that's neat. People don't realize that sometimes it just takes a little spark to get you going in a different direction, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, part of my lab, I'm somewhat unique as a scientist in that I'm not as focused as perhaps most scientists are. I have two very distinct arms in my laboratory, but the one area where I have been funded continuously for more than 20 years, and what I'll be talking about at Texas A&M when I visit, is my interest in physical activity and bone health. And I was very reluctant to get into that. It was in 1989, when I was a postdoctoral fellow at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, that my mentor at the time, John Holsey, asked me if I would be willing to lead a project evaluating the beneficial effects of exercise training on bone density in older women, because at that time, very little was known.
Yeah.
And my first response to him was, not really, because watching bones grow is about as interesting as watching grass grow, except grass grows faster. But it has been an intriguing area for me to study, and I remain very interested in trying to identify novel factors that influence how our bones can become stronger through exercise.
And, you know, it's a fascinating area because so many people think that bone doesn't change. You know, it's hard, it's unyielding, and it seems to be a rather plastic tissue, doesn't it?
It is much more so than we thought. Our perceptions of things, of the body, have changed dramatically even in my lifetime. We used to think that bone was very inert. It was just there as a structure to support us. We know that isn't true. We used to think that fat was just a place to store excess calories, but now we know that that secretes a lot of factors that regulate metabolism. And in fact, there's a lot of communication between fat and bone. So probably all of our physiological systems in our body communicate with each other in ways that we hardly appreciate.
Well, tell me about this communication between fat and bone.
Well, it's been interesting. This is something that's emerged probably in the last 5 years or so. We know that the cells, the progenitor cells that can be converted into bone-building cells can also be converted into fat cells.
So these are like stem cells or satellite cells,
Yeah. Okay. And they're typically the stem cells from the mesenchymal lineage that can be converted both to osteoblasts, which are bone building cells, or adipocytes, which are fat cells. And there's some very intriguing science out there now suggesting that at the time of menopause, when women lose much of their ovarian function, they stop making estrogen and other female hormones, that we've known for a long time that they have a fairly dramatic loss of bone that begins at that time.
Mm-hmm.
What is not as well appreciated, at least in the scientific communities, I think all women know this, is that they start having a greater propensity to gain weight, and they start putting on fat in places where they haven't stored it before. And there is some evidence now that there is some sort of a switch by which these progenitor stem cells start being converted to fat cells instead of to bone cells.
Interesting. So so instead of going into bone, they decided they're going to become fat cells.
Right.
And that leads increased weight gain. Yeah, weight gain after menopause. Wow.
Correct.
So of course the question is, what's the trigger?
Yeah, we don't know the mechanisms yet, but we're doing some interesting studies in young women right now where we're suppressing their sex hormone levels for a few months, and we're getting adipose tissue biopsy samples to try to get an idea of just how fat is expanding. We're looking for whether there's evidence of new adipocytes, new fat cells actually being formed. And our very preliminary evidence suggests that that is indeed happening. So now we just have to find out why.
Well, you know, I think the first thing that people think about when they talk about menopause is the lack of estrogen or the reduction of estrogen. Does estrogen play a role in this at all?
We think it does. We will be studying that. Right now we have women who, when we suppress their hormone levels, are also given a skin patch to wear, and that patch can either be a placebo, which means it's totally inactive, or it can have estrogen on it that actually goes through the skin into the blood system. Right now, I'm blinded to know whether someone's receiving a placebo or estrogen treatment, but when we get to the point in the study where we start analyzing the data, then we'll be able to determine whether we do in fact see this increase in new fat cells being produced in the placebo-treated women, which is what we would predict, and whether that's being prevented in the women who are given the estrogen treatment.
Wow. You talk about some really interesting studies that are ongoing right now. Where would people look to find out what you find when you get done with this? I mean, how would someone find that?
Well, they can always go to our website here at the University of Colorado, although, you know, I don't have that web address handy because we just changed all of our university domains.
Yeah, we'll find it and put it in the show notes.
Okay, So for my research group, what we try to do on our webpage is post at least links to all of the abstracts of our studies so that participants who come into our lab know that they can go there and find out what we're doing and what the results are of the study that they participated in. But I think the other important thing for the public to know is that the National Institutes of Health has become very proactive about making sure that the public has access to the research that their federal dollars are supporting. So there's something called PubMed Central that anyone can go to, and all NIH-supported research papers will be accessible to anyone through that site. So, you know, if you're inclined to actually go back to the source of the publication, that's one way to become informed.
Yeah.
But then I think also the press does a fairly good job at picking up important stories about new research findings. So there's always mechanisms through the lay press for people to become informed also.
Right. So this ongoing story that you're investigating right now, there are many ways folks can actually access what the ending of the story is, or what the next step is, I should say, anyway. Then go to your website. They can go to PubMed Central. They just type that into Google. And sometimes the press does a great job with that kind of stuff. So just watch the newspapers, huh?
Right.
In whatever format they're going to be in the future.
Right.
Yeah. We were talking about your lab. You said something about your lab group there. And can you tell us a little bit about what the Image Research Group is?
Yeah. Image is the name we've coined for ourselves. That stands for Investigations in Metabolism, Aging, Gender, and Exercise, which gives you sort of the umbrella look at the sort of research that we do.
Mm.
Being based in the center or in the Division of Geriatric Medicine, we're very interested in aging in general, and specifically at how a healthy lifestyle can prevent accelerated aging. We don't think it prevents aging, but we think if you're inactive, if you're sedentary, the aging process may become accelerated. So we're always interested in whether exercise, nutrition, or other lifestyle approaches to managing your health, if that can predispose you to successful aging.
Okay.
And that's defined not only by how long you live, but also by the quality of life as you get older. So how well you live. Right. Whether you can remain living independently, or whether you become disabled and have to live in an assisted living environment. So a lot of our research is intervention-based, using lifestyle interventions. And we also try to focus our research on translation from preclinical to clinical applicability. So we like to identify mechanisms that have been discovered in cells or in animals and determine what their physiologic relevance is in humans.
Mm.
So we have a very interesting line of research going on right now that I'll talk about a little bit more when I'm there, about whether using drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen blocks some of the adaptations to exercise, some of the beneficial effects. And what turned me on to this was, I remember reading a paper back in 1988 or so about a study in animals where they gave them a drug like ibuprofen before they applied mechanical stress to bone. And the bone formation response was completely blocked by that drug.
So if they took ibuprofen, they didn't develop bone like they should have?
Well, this was just an acute loading study.
Okay.
So normally in animals, if you apply mechanical stress to bone and then you do some more sophisticated measures, you can actually see that the bone formation process has been turned on by that physical stress to bone.
Hmm.
And this has been observed repeatedly in a number of different animal models, where if you have drugs like ibuprofen, these are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs,
yeah,
if they're present before you apply mechanical stress to bone, the bone formation response just does not occur. But if you introduce the drug after you have loaded the bone, then the bone formation response seems to be fairly normal.
Hmm.
The limitation in animal studies is that, you know, they're just interested in mechanisms.
Right.
So they have identified these mechanisms. They've never carried out the study to determine if you load that bone on a daily basis with or without non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs present, do you indeed block the adaptation repeatedly?
Hmm.
So we have done what I think I'm pretty sure is the first and only study to evaluate that in humans, where we had young women coming into our laboratory three or four times a week for 9 months, engaging in a bone loading exercise program that was designed to increase bone density. And they took two study pills on any day that they exercised. They took one before exercise and one after. So they could have gotten either ibuprofen before and placebo after, or placebo before and ibuprofen after, or placebo at both time points.
Okay.
And we did find that it was the group that took ibuprofen before they exercised that had the least favorable adaptations to the exercise program in terms of changes in bone density.
So their activities of daily life didn't offset that? I mean, like just walking around doesn't provide enough of a bone loading mechanism to offset what the ibuprofen was doing?
Well, no, and that's... I think that the response to that is what people do on a daily basis is what their skeletons are accustomed to seeing. So when we brought them into the lab, we were actually having them engage in more vigorous exercise, trying to get them to increase their bone density. And it was that increase in response to the exercise program that seemed to be blocked by taking ibuprofen before exercise. But a very unexpected finding in that preliminary study was that the group that took ibuprofen after they exercised actually had larger improvements than we were expecting. So now we have studies going on in the lab to try to follow up on that, to confirm what we observed in our first study, and also to try to understand why we might be seeing benefits of taking ibuprofen after exercise on bone density.
Well, there's so many avenues of questions that we can go from here. I guess some of my past experience has been with marathoners and long-distance runners, and they always wind up taking ibuprofen to mask the pain, either during the run or after the run. And so if they were taking ibuprofen after their run, then they actually could be adding to their bone density, but if they did it before the run, it might hinder some of that.
Well, that keep in mind, this has only been one study,
sure,
and it was a small one. It's a preliminary one, but that might be...
But it was a good study.
Right, well, of course. That, on the surface, is what we might predict, but this is a complex system. There are a number of factors to consider. I mean, it could be that even though you get an increase in bone density by taking these drugs after exercise, it might be that in the long run that is not necessarily a good thing, because we think that this benefit might be mediated by suppressing bone turnover levels. And you actually, in the long term, you have to have bone turnover. You have cells that come in and chew up, literally, old bone. They acidify it, so you're always getting rid of some old bone and building new bone in its place. So if taking NSAIDs after exercise dampens that process, it's possible that over many months or many years, you might accumulate micro damage in bone that isn't getting repaired effectively. And that could end up being an adverse effect in the long run, even though it appears to be a beneficial effect in the short run. So we have a lot to learn yet. We're not at the point of being able to recommend that people should take these drugs to improve their bone density, but the point is that we need to understand the mechanisms, because I think there are a lot of people who take ibuprofen and these types of drugs, maybe not before or after specifically, but when they're exercising to try to reduce the discomforts,
and they
could be counteracting some of the benefits that they might otherwise get.
Well, I know it's speculation because it is based on this one excellent study. So would you advise older individuals not to take these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the NSAIDs?
We're doing the study right now in older folks, so we'll know better in about a year or so. But actually, the story gets even more complex than I've led you to believe so far. Because I've told you that...
Well, science usually is that way, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
One question leads to 30 more.
Sure.
So NSAIDs can block the effects of exercise on bone formation. But NSAIDs can also influence the bone resorption process. In fact, they might have anti-resorptive effects independent of exercise, so just on normal bone metabolism. So in older women, postmenopausal women, one of the reasons that they lose bone is because the rate of bone resorption or bone loss accelerates after the menopause. And many of the drugs that are used to treat osteoporosis are anti-resorptive drugs. So if non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs have anti-resorptive effects, they could actually be beneficial in postmenopausal women or in other individuals who have high bone turnover rates. So not only do we need to understand how ibuprofen might be influencing adaptations to exercise in young women, we need to do the studies in older individuals, basically in individuals across the age span, because bone turnover rates can vary quite dramatically by sex and by age.
So there may be good and there may be bad.
Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, and you're right. Science does always lead us to these conundrums sometimes. And it's a fun puzzle to tease out on one hand, and on the other hand, it can have some, large potential health ramifications as well.
It can, and unexpected ones.
Yeah. We're running out of time here, and so we're going to wrap up a little bit. So we always allow our guests, if they had one take-home message that they wanted to tell our audience, what would that take-home message be?
Well, I had the privilege of serving on the advisory committee that generated the evidence report for the first physical activity guidelines for Americans. And it was a great experience for me, but when I sat around the table with these 13 other scientists from around the country and discussed the numerous and varied benefits of physical activity on health, I think the best message that I, as an exercise scientist, can give to the public is that you should remain as physically active as you can be throughout your lifespan. If there's one thing you can do to try to ensure good health, it would be to be physically active and to exercise regularly. So I think that's a message that people have heard repeatedly, but I don't think they appreciate how potent the health benefits of exercise are.
And there's just more and more data that's coming out every day
that
shows it is the cheapest medicine available.
Right.
And probably most effective medicine available.
And exercise is medicine.
You're absolutely. I'm wearing my shirt today, as a matter of fact, that says exercise is medicine.
Good for you.
So we're all together on that one today.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today. We've really enjoyed the conversation. And I would really encourage our listeners to come out, if you're near the College Station Bryan area, to come out on November 30th, 6:45 p.m. We'll be in the Interdisciplinary Life Sciences Building in the auditorium there. It's a big, beautiful new facility here on campus. If you want more information and maps on how to get here, if you'll come to our website, where you can actually also subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, go to huffinesinstitute.tamu.edu/podcast, and make sure you put an S on that. That is a plural. And you'll see not only this podcast, but you'll also see a link to the maps and the announcements about Dr. Court's talk here on November the 30th. Again, thank you so much, Wendy, for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you here in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Tim.
Okay, and we hope everyone out there has a great week, and we just remind you to be active and be well.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.